So, I was really torn on the title today. Anytime I go to do a sermon that involves worry, I always want to go back to that song, Don't Worry, Be Happy. I don't know why, anytime I hear the word worry, that's the song that always comes to mind. And for a Christian, that is really true. Why do we worry? We praise and worship a God who created everything around us, who created us, who knew when we'd be here, when we won't, where we'll be at every second of every day of our entire life, what we're thinking at every moment in our life. Who's able to know at every precise moment, every single hair on our head, for everybody. But yet, we still suffer with this. We still tend to want to work. What we have to keep in mind is that if he can do all that, if he can know all that, if he can be everywhere, if he is that truly awesome, if he is that truly awesome, then why in the world do we worry? Because he can overcome every single obstacle. He has sovereignty over every situation, every problem. We're going to continue in the books of Acts, starting in chapter 27. And we're continuing where Paul has finished up and his appeal's being granted to go see Caesar to have his case heard. And now he's going to sail for Rome. And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius, and embarking in a ship of Andromedium, which was about to sail for the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, and the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus, because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea, along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra and Lysa. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, as the wind did not allow us to go further. We sailed under the ice of Crete off Salmon, and coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lysi. Since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous because of even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. And because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided that they should put out to sea from there, on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. So we know from this that Paul had experience with sailing. He knew the seas. He knew the conditions of that area. So did they. That's why they were kind of in a hurry and they really wanted to get to a specific port. Now, I find it incredibly amusing when I read the Bible and you hear a harbor named Fairhaven. They go, "Oh, we don't want to stay there for the winter." And in that area, it wouldn't have been one of the better ones, but it still was a nice one. It was a decent one, but they wanted to get to that specific one. Paul gave them a warning, and they didn't listen. And a lot of people ask on this one, I go, wow, how was Paul given this warning? It's a very key point to this story. Did Paul get this warning because it was a divine revelation to him, or because of his own knowledge? And a lot of times we go, oh, he is an apostle, and he got it all straight from God. Well, in this passage here, Paul gives warning that if they do make it, there's going to be a great loss. Which was true, they do lose a lot. But he said, not just of cargo, but of life. And when we get a little further in, we're going to find out Paul was wrong on that. Ship does lose a lot. They lose a lot of cargo, but they didn't lose a lot of life. So we know at this point, with that fact in mind, and that God's never wrong, can't be wrong if he's all-knowing, right? That this warning he was giving was from his own knowledge, his own personal knowledge. After this point, we continue on in verse 13 where there's the storm at sea. Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. Now at this time, they're approaching the winter months, and that nice gentle wind in this area at that time was known to be a warning. So that's why they wanted to take off right away to follow this, because generally it was a sign that there was a big storm coming. In verse 14, but soon a tempestuous wind called the Northeaster struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Kata, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. What this meant was these boats carried a lifeboat with them, but it wasn't strapped to the side. It wasn't on top. Normally, they had it towing behind them. There's a little rope running to it, and the boat would run behind them. Because of the storm, that was causing a lot of issues for the ship. So they pulled that boat up on top, pulled the lifeboat into the ship with them. And then they took ropes and ran under the ship, around it. And the reason they did this is because the waves were getting worse and worse. They were worried about what they might hit. If they run into the sand, if they run into rocks, if it's just the pure water rocking the ship back and forth, that those boards of the ship might start coming apart. So what they're doing is they're basically running a net, building a net under around all the wood to hold that ship together as they're going through this great storm. Then fearing that they would run aground on the streets, they lowered the gear. And thus, they were driven along. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Now, it's not tackle like a tackle box. What it means here is they were throwing overboard all the spare parts of the ship. Everything they needed to work on the ship, they were getting rid of. And it kind of sounds kind of odd. Okay, you're facing a giant storm. Why would you get rid of everything you need to repair a boat when you think you're going to have a damaged boat? What they wanted to do was make that boat as light as possible, so that way it stood less of a chance of running into any of the sands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of being saved was lost and last abandoned. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of God, to whom I belong and whom I worship." The angel of God, the very God I belong to, the very God I preach about, the very God I've been given you testimonies about while you've all been around me. And if that's what his angel is coming to tell me, his messengers came to tell me, then you can take heart that you're going to get through this. He said, do not be afraid, because I must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all, those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I've been told. But we must run aground on some island. When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea about midnight, the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther on, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under the pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. So it's been 14 days now. 14 days where they're cloudy all day, can't see the sun, and they can't see the stars, and they have no GPS, so they have no idea where they're at. But they know as the ship's moving along here that the depths is getting smaller and smaller. They're getting closer and closer to the bottom. Those in charge were thinking about trying to abandon that ship. That's why they were trying to put that lifeboat back in, but this time they decided to listen to Paul. Verse 32, then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all 276 persons in the ship, and when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. Now, there's always been a lot of questions on that. 276 people in a ship at that time. A lot of people saying, you go back then, they didn't have the big cruisers, they weren't made of metal, it was all these wood ships. How could they possibly fit that many people on this ship? Well, if we dig into history, the ship in that area that was known for carrying the wheat, that was carrying the food, they were big ships. It would have carried the 276 people at that time with no trouble. Those ships were known for carrying a lot of people. So there's no doubt that at that time, in that moment, that many people were on that ship because it was entirely possible. The other thing that gets questioned is, why was no one eating? 14 days is a long time. Why wouldn't anybody want to eat? That lets us know one thing, how bad that storm really was. There's people who get seasick when it's just a little bit of rocking. Now picture a boat getting tossed back and forth nonstop for 14 days. Everybody's stomach would be a little queasy at that point. So they were having trouble with it because they were all a little nauseous. They were running out of hope because they knew they were getting more and more lost. Now, we look at the maps and we start going, oh, really? How can it take them 14 days? How can this all happen? It really shouldn't have been that long of a trip. Well, believe it or not, people have actually drawn it up, and experienced sailors from that area who know the winds, know the waters, actually researched this. And they drew it out, and they calculate, well, the storms are like this, and we know there's storms in that area like this. How long would it really take for this entire trip. They come out with, forgive me if I'm a little off, 13 days, and I believe it was 8 hours, 43 minutes, and I forget how many seconds they threw on there. So it's entirely possible that was 14 days. It fit that bill perfect. They're trying to sail a little way. The storm came out of nowhere. Suddenly, this short trip's taking a long time. No one knows where they're going. No one knows where they're at. No star in the sky. No sun during the day. Here in Northeast Ohio, we can all sympathize with what it's like to see nothing but clouds for days on end. But picture that, being in a boat on a stormy sea. We can all sympathize with how low their hopes would have been at that point. How much they would have been saying, it's going to be over. This is it. I'm never going to see anyone I know again. It's a moment of crisis. Now, if we go to the media today, how does the media present Christians in a crisis? Generally, Christians in general, depending on the media station, are presented as overall nice people, but generally not very smart. Sometimes they're not presented as very nice people, but we're going to go with that one because it's a little easier to handle. We'll give them a little credibility. Generally, they present the Christians as the person who's just calling out in the middle of the crisis, you just need to turn to God. Just shouting that out over and over, but really doing nothing for the people in the situation. And the truth is, it's presented as being completely false in the Bible. In this moment of darkness, in this moment of chaos, in the situation where everybody feels there's nothing they can do, the Christian is the one standing up using his knowledge and experience to tell them what they need to do, to calm them down. How can that be? Why isn't he in a panic mode? Why isn't he at that phase and just accepting the fact that this is it? God's ready to call me up. Time's over. And call him because of that. No, because he looked around, seen what was going on, and said, there's something I can do about the now. I don't have to worry if the ship ever runs ashore. I can do something now. Then God gave him a vision and let him know that everything was going to be okay. And he told him all about it. He told him about the hope. He kept bringing that up, hope over and over again to these people. Remember, we're in the book of Acts now. It's a chapter that's a very evangelistic nature. And for the most part, it's a very aggressive evangelism. But when we get to this moment of utter chaos, the style of evangelism has changed. In this moment of chaos, he's not standing there shouting, turn to God now because this is your last chance. He's not being that aggressive. He's not telling them all, look around you, you're about to die, you better give your life over now. That's not what he's doing. He's calming everything down, and he's telling them, here's why I'm calm. It's a very mild evangelism. When these people are in chaos, the last thing they need is more chaos for somebody screaming at them, your life is over, turn to God. With somebody softly saying, look, it's not over. God's going to protect us. Listen to me, calm down. Have some food. You haven't eaten. You need to get your strength up. If we're running around, you need to swim. You need some strength. Eat now. If we eat now, we can toss it overboard, lighten the ship so we can get closer to land. He's working God into it. The testimony's there. The witnessing is there. But it's a subtle witness. It's not an in-your-face. It's a, this is just part of life. It's part of my life. It's part of the choice I made. And that's what the testimony is here. Far too often, when we see people going through chaos, we just want to shout at them. Open your eyes. That's not what the Bible points us to do. In these moments of chaos, we're to remain calm. We're to give them a mild witness statement to make sure they know we're just trying to give them the encouragement they need to take that next step. So we need to remember that when we go into those times of chaos, that that's how we're to witness in those times of chaos. Not to live up to the expectations on the world, the secular world, of being the people standing on the street corner with the sign yelling, "The world's coming to an end. Turn over now before it's too late." But the one saying, "Here's what you can do here and now. Here's how I'm taking that next step. Let me give you some encouragement. Let them know God created the sun and it ain't going anywhere. You might not be able to see it, but it's still above the clouds. That's why there's light enough for us to see, even though it seems dark. And the stars are still there. Eventually those clouds are going to lift and we'll know exactly where we're at. So we don't need to panic." Granted, he might not give us the vision to be able to say, "Hey, an angel came to me and told me that not a hair on anybody's head would be harmed." Now, we might not be able to go to that extent. But it does give us, and he does give us, the ability to encourage people when they need it. To let his hope shine when there's none. To let his light shine when there's none. And after they did all that, did it get better? Well, not quite. Verse 39, "Now then it was day. They did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore." That would have seemed like the easy way there. "So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders. Then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf." So it got stuck before it reached that nice sandy beach to sail into, on basically rocks, and the surf was hitting that boat and smashing it into the rocks over and over and over again. So the boat's being broken up. Verse 42, "The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape." It sounds a little drastic, but remember, these soldiers were responsible. If any single prisoner escaped, their life would be over. They'd get executed for it. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. So it was that all were brought safely to land. So they made it there. Some had to float in, some swam in, but they all made it to land. Chapter 28, "And after we were brought safely through, we learned that the island was called Malta. The native people showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and welcomed us all, because it had begun to rain and was cold. When Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and put them on fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. It bit his hand. It was hanging there. When the native people saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, 'No doubt this man is a murderer. Though he has escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live.' He, however, shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. They were waiting for him to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But when they had waited a long time and saw no misfortune come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. Now in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the chief man of the island named Publius, who received us and entertained us hospitably for 3 days. It happened that the father of Publius lay sick with fever and dysentery, and Paul visited him and prayed, and putting his hands on him, healed him. And when this had taken place, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases all came and were cured. They also honored us greatly. And when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed. Now, in these times of crisis, it's far too easy to jump to a conclusion. Times of grief, times when these situations happen, it can be very rough to try and understand why. Take, for example, we have a man, he's on his way to the airport, gets stuck in heavy traffic, misses his plane by 15 minutes, can't get on it. He's upset at the time. Then finds out on the news later that night, while he's still complaining, that disaster happened on that plane and it crashed. And his family rejoices. He rejoices, saying, "That's why I was in the accident, so God could save me." Huh? He was a man of God. God protected him. But we can't jump to that conclusion. We're just as bad as the people in here that because he was bitten by the snake, he deserved it. Because on that same plane, there might have been another situation for another Christian family. And how do we explain that? The husband who was on that plane when it crashed, of a wife, a very devoted Christian wife, whose future for herself and her 3 children is now uncertain because her faithful husband made it in time to get on that plane. We can't jump to the conclusion there and say instantly, that's because he did something unjust. We have no idea what the reasons are. And we don't need to worry what the reasons are. We don't need to understand that. Why shouldn't we be worrying about that? Because God is sovereign over all situations. We don't know what the reasons are, why somebody has to suffer and somebody doesn't. We don't know what's going on. We can't see the big picture. But we know God does. We need to make sure we don't rush to that judgment, because when we do, are we really even helping this fellow Christian out? If she knows everybody's looking at her saying her husband did something and that's why, is that the fellowship she needs in that moment? Is that going to give her the hope? Is that going to show her God's light in this time of chaos? We're called to be the one who's giving hope when there's no hope. Maybe the difference is because the first man's family wasn't strong enough yet to go on without him. But that this other wife was going to come into situations years later. And because of what she went through then, maybe she's able to overcome that. Maybe it has to do with one of the children. Maybe it has to do with one of the grandchildren. Maybe it's the great-great-great-great-grandchildren. We don't know. But because of that event that happened back then, some they're able to give that child or give that person the hope they need to come through what they need to come through. For that trial that's going to be faced years later. Maybe that very moment something that she's going to share later that saves another family that's facing a time of disaster and doesn't know God yet. We have no idea. And quite frankly, I really don't want to know that much. I'm very happy that God knows it all and I don't have to. Because God's all powerful and He knows. He doesn't have to worry. He created it all. He knows what's going on. And because I know that, I don't even have to worry about not knowing what tomorrow brings, what the next moment brings. That I can sit back and know that God was sovereign over that situation. But it's not a sit back and do nothing knowledge. It's a sit back and know that I'm just here to give hope when there is no hope. And that when I'm in that time of darkness, He has somebody else there to bring that hope to me. Let's continue on. Verse 11, after 3 months, skipping ahead a little bit. After 3 months, we set sail on a ship that had wintered in the island, a ship of Alexandria, with the twin gods as figurehead, putting in at Syracuse. We stayed there for 3 days, and from there we made a circuit and arrived at Rhegium. And after one day, a south wind sprang up. And on the second day, we came to Puteoli. There we found brothers and were invited to stay with them for 7 days. And so we came to Rome. And the brothers there, when they heard about us, came as far as Forum of Appius and three taverns to meet us. On seeing them, Paul thanked God and took courage. Upon seeing them, Paul thanked God and took courage. The task of being a Christian is to witness to others. It's not something we do hidden. We learn that from a very young age with a simple song of "This Little Light of Mine, I'm going to Let It Shine." We're called to witness in public. We're called to witness to friends, to family, to everyone that God brings us to, because in that moment, and there's that little voice that tells us we should say something. God brought you there to give a witness statement. The thing about it is, giving that witness statement in public and open is very hard. It doesn't matter if you're the best at it or the worst at it. It's hard for both. It's very draining. It's emotionally draining. Because a lot of the times you're sharing things and you're listening to somebody and you're sympathizing with them. And it can be emotionally exhausting. It's even more emotionally exhausting if you're trying to present that and you see them suffering and you know if they listen a little bit, you can help. But it's not being heard. If you know there's a person that does that over and over again, it's very hard for them. And with everything they deal with, it's often very discouraging for them. But in the very end of this, we're told what we need to do. When they heard this, he was coming there, they traveled there to greet him. And when he seen them, he seen that fellowship was there. He's not alone. He might be standing in public. He might have been the one that was the main speaker in those areas. He might be the one that's taking all the suffering for it. But when he got there, he seen the friends, he seen the fellowship, and knew he wasn't alone. He got encouragement from that. And that's what we need to do. For Christians who stand boldly for Christ, we need to give them encouragement. It's just small acts of affirmation. As simple as a letter being sent. And I can tell you from personal experience, it's truly amazing when you're going through something and you're at that point where you're feeling emotionally exhausted. Where you're asking God, why am I here? Why do I have to deal with this? And out of nowhere, you pick up this letter that says, we're praying for you. We're thinking of you. Stay strong in your ministry. If you need us, know we're here. We get that out of the blue. That's God at work. It's a reminder that God is truly sovereign over every circumstance. And that doesn't mean we don't have free will to make a choice in those circumstances. What it means is God just already knows what we're going to choose to do. But it works out better for us when we decide to follow His will instead of ours. When we start listening to that little voice, even when we really don't want to. Because even Paul, one of the apostles, who had an amazing vision, who followed that vision, had a grand testimony going from persecutor to preacher. Had times when he needed that encouragement, that fellowship. And everybody will always have those times. Let us pray. Dear Heavenly Father, I thank you for your living word, the truth contained in it. How encouraging it can be, even when so challenging. How much love and knowledge pours out of it. And how the truth is always there when we want to hear it, and especially when we don't. And Lord, I thank you that no matter what the situation, no matter what the storm is in our life, we know you're sovereign over it all. I thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.